Happy Monday. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Jisoo Ki, or you can just call me G. A quieter day for us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. U.S. stock and bond markets are closed today in observance of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Here's a little trivia fact. The market closure for King's birthday is relatively new. When the holiday was signed into law by President Ronald Reagan in 1983 and officially established in 1986, the New York Stock Exchange and other major exchanges remained open, actually, observing only a minute of silence at noon. It wasn't until January 19th, 1998, that the New York Stock Exchange first said that they would take the full day off. We've got a great show for you today. Hopefully you have the day off and you're enjoying the show while you're running some errands or enjoying your lunch. We've got talk about apprenticeships and why they're on the rise and why you might consider a trade school, especially if you've a kid or granddaughter that's about to turn 18 thinking about college. Trade schools are also a really wonderful option, and we're going to talk to an expert about that, and he's a workforce development and skills expert and author. Also, we're going to be talking about when you should retire, how much money you should have, and also look at the best states to retire in. But we're going to start with Steve Burness, who is president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau. Steve, you are a favorite of WGN Radio, and welcome. This is the first time I've seen you in person in 2020.
Since last decade.
I know. So there was so much talk. We covered it on the show last week about Windows 7 dying.
Sure.
And there were a lot of PC users that hadn't done the updates, that weren't prepared, even though the updates were free. And, you know, everyone was saying, you've got to fix this before there's not going to be any more support for this.
Correct.
Ever again. And you say that there are people out there so creatively are creating a scam out of this, too.
The scammers listen to the radio, watch TV just like us, and they try to profit on the consumers in some way. And they figured a way to do this one. So the Better Business Bureau is receiving a plethora of calls on from consumers who have received calls or emails from individuals or corporations that they said they could help them in upgrading from Windows 7 to Windows 10. And we just need your password, we need your credit card, you have to pay a licensing fee. There's so many different variances of this particular scam. In essence, Microsoft, Bill Gates, will not call you up to tell you that you need an upgrade. And they won't need your credit card right there on the spot. It's just the scammers are trying to profit on these consumers who really haven't heard what's going on and how dire the situation is to them. And unfortunately, they're losing their money and they're reporting it to the Better Business Bureau.
So what are the calls like? How do they start? And how do you, I mean, I guess no one should really be calling you about your Windows 7.
Right. They're still calling and they're actually sending emails. A lot of them are emails where they get an email from them saying it's from Microsoft and that you have to take care of your system because you have an old system and you won't work anymore. It'll lock up on you. They're kind of giving you that scare tactic that something is direly wrong with your system unless, of course, you give us your credit card or give us access to your computer, and we can help you. We can dial in and go through it. But unfortunately, they have an ulterior motive in mind, and they want access to your computer and put some spam and malware on it.
It sounds so easy, like you wouldn't fall for such a thing, but the emails are pretty savvy. They look like they come from Microsoft. You're in a heap of trouble if you're Windows 7 user and you didn't prepare for this. So yeah, then you click on the link.
Right. The emails look great. They look like from Microsoft directly. They just copy and paste the link. That's why it looks like it's coming from Microsoft. They have the address of Microsoft on there and everything like that. And the phone calls, which is more alarmingly, have Microsoft as a caller ID. So consumers are seeing that it's Microsoft phone number, whatever number they have on there. But again, consumers need to remember that caller ID can be spoofed with a simple $20 program. Most consumers don't realize they believe the phone who's behind it by when they answer it. And unfortunately, it's not the case. So when they see Microsoft, they kind of go, hey, it's got to be Microsoft, when actually it's not. It's a scammer who figured out a way to separate you from your money.
And they are offering a free Windows 10 upgrade right now. So you can just find that online and do that.
Do that yourself as well. And nobody's going to call you out of the blue, as you mentioned, G, that nobody's going to call you and say they can help you or need your credit card number to fix this for you. If you do have some problems with the computer, please go to somebody you know and trust and have vetted in some way. Just don't follow a link in an email. It happens all the time. Never follow links in emails. If you want to deal with the corporation itself and you're interested in it, go to the website directly of the company.
I even know not to follow links in my emails, but sometimes I just lose track of what I'm doing and I think, oh, and I'm like, wait, what did I do? Don't click on that G. I'm telling myself.
Exactly.
So, you know, you can't, I don't blame folks for doing it sometimes.
It's hard. It's really hard to do. Sometimes you got to hover over and see where actually the email is going because it goes to a third party source. It's not going to the company it's saying it's going to.
Okay. So it's going to be tax season soon. January 27th, it begins, correct?
Yes,
so
exactly.
One bit of warning that you'd like to give advice right now.
Well, they're going to have these imposter scams, and it's going to happen all the time. So you're going to get calls or emails saying they're from the IRS, they're going to help you with your taxes, or you're owed a refund and you haven't cashed your check yet, we need some more information from you. Any way to get you to give up your personal information, and people are somewhat gullible in these situations because they know it's tax time. They know they just did their taxes or maybe doing their taxes and they're getting a call or an email from the IRS. You got to do something about it. And they're threatening. They're not just nice. Hey, this is the IRS. You're going to jail. You're going to be deported. You're going to lose your driver's license, whatever it may be. These imposter scams, the Better Business Bureau has seen a plethora of them. And they're coming from everywhere, from Social Security, from the IRS, from your local police departments to your local municipalities. Everybody's trying to make you do something within 30 minutes. And that's usually what we call the tip-off to the rip-off. The only thing you need to do in 30 minutes is buy a pizza, and that's it. Everything else that people want you to do in 30 minutes is a scam because they don't want you to think about it. They want you to give your credit card.
And the IRS will never call you.
Never.
They will always send you a letter in the mail.
Exactly. They'll send you a letter in the mail to contact them. None of these municipalities or these People's Gas or ComEd will not call you and demand payment within 30 minutes. They don't do that. They do the normal process of the channels of communication. So if you get a call or an email and you've got to do something quickly, again, that's the tip off to the rip off.
Well, you know what? Steve Burness, president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau, my sweet mama fell for that. The IRS called her and told her they were going to take her to jail. And she told them her social security number. And I was
no,
mom. Yeah. Okay, Steve, thank you so much for being with us today. And your website?
BBB.org. Before you buy or hire, BBB it.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. We've been hearing a lot about the ongoing trade war facing the manufacturing sector, but something else that's more of an immediate problem is the growing skills gap. The National Association of Manufacturers says that a record 522,000 jobs remained open in the sector in the last couple of months. Another report also found that 4.6 million jobs will need to be filled in the sector over the next decade, and 2.4 million jobs may be left open due to a lack of trained workers. Joining us now is a workforce development and skills expert and author, Nicholas Wyman, also the CEO of Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation. Nicholas, how are you?
Hey, I'm great, G. Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, I gave some statistics about the gap, the growing skills gap, and the lack of being able to fill all of these great jobs that are in the manufacturing sector. And you're going to talk a little bit about apprenticeships and why that may be a solution to this problem and why apprenticeships are on the rise.
Yeah, absolutely. It's when you hear those stats, you start to say, well, what is going on? Because our education systems are churning out graduates, but the graduates aren't meeting the needs of employers. And what we've also got going on is this age of globalization and technological change. So it's not just one force. It's a whole lot of different things that are impacting at the same time. So it does present opportunity, but I think it also, we really need to dive into some of this data and say, well, what's going on and where is the opportunity?
Nicholas, let's start from the beginning. Explain what an apprenticeship is.
Right, an apprenticeship. So an apprenticeship is actually, it's not a reality television show. And I noticed in one of the reports you referenced that 85% in Illinois, 85% of apprentices are in the building construction industry. So globally, that's not the case. So apprenticeship is not just building construction. It's not a reality show. So what actually is an apprenticeship? It's really learning by doing. So you can undertake an apprenticeship, which takes 2, maybe 3 years. It's the Western world's oldest form of occupational learning. And what I think a lot of people across the country are realizing is that apprenticeships are not just for building construction. There's a whole lot of different industries, IT, healthcare. So it's just a different way to learn skills. And I think that a lot of people are concerned about, college tuition, crippling loan debt. So it's an alternate. It's not the only path, but it's another path.
It's a path that really needs to be considered, because I think a lot of parents just think, oh, the kids got to go to a four-year university or a college. And you're saying apprenticeships and trade schools might be the way to go.
Well, there are a lot of elements with apprenticeship that particularly suit young people. But I should say that we're not just talking young people. It's all ages, all stages.
Apprenticeship, good point.
Yeah. So quite often people say, well, this is something for young people, or, there's a lot of people where there's industries changing and, you can go back and do some studies, go and talk to a community college. So I think that one of the things I really like about apprenticeship is that there's definitely mentoring and coaching built in. So you're not just learning the technical skill, you're also learning skills of that industry, because what we know about this technological change is that the technical skills will change. And I think we've all, come to terms with that. Technology is going to change the technical skills. But I think what an apprenticeship teaches you is this sort of broader array of skills, which you're going to be able to take from job to job or from industry to industry. So there's a lot of positives in apprenticeship.
Talking with workforce development and skills expert Nicholas Wyman, who's also the CEO of Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation. Nicholas, I wanted to read you a little excerpt from the Illinois Economic Policy Institute and the Project for Middle Class Renewal at the University of Illinois. It specifically singles out Illinois' joint labor management construction apprenticeship programs as a model that can be duplicated, as you said, in other industries with high demand for skilled workers, such as IT, nursing, or manufacturing. The part I thought that was very fascinating was that these apprenticeships offer a path to the middle class with access to jobs that pay at least $40 an hour, which is a very, very good thing.
Absolutely. And that really breaks down one of the key myths that modern apprenticeship graduates, the perception is, these are low-skilled, low-wage jobs. The average starting wage for apprentices is actually above $60,000 a year. If you look at 2018-19 stats for college grads, they could expect to make an average of about $50,000 annually. So, there's a lot to be said for following this sort of pathway. And I think the construction model, and this article talks about the construction sector quite broadly. This is something that's been, going on in building construction for decades and decades and decades. But it is interesting. It's an American thing that building construction is really where apprenticeships have been set. If you look to Germany, Switzerland, the UK, even my homeland, Australia, apprenticeships have always been sort of more broadly across other industries, particularly tourism, hospitality, service sectors. But one thing we are seeing is a huge spike in IT and tech opportunities, and also in advanced manufacturing, which you mentioned at the top of our conversation.
Well, something you might not know is that there is a new apprenticeship education tax credit that Governor J.B. Pritzker signed into law last August. And this bill offers employers a tax credit of up to $3,500 to cover educational expenses for each qualifying apprentice and up to $5,000 for those in underserved areas. So, Nicholas, if there's one thing you'd want the listener to take away from this conversation, what would it be?
I think that modern apprenticeship offers a broad array of career pathways.
Fantastic. And I love that it doesn't discriminate based on age, and it's becoming much more diverse as well as to who engages in apprenticeships.
Absolutely. And I think it's for all people. So there's plenty of ways to engage. And that that credit is a fantastic way for employers to jump on board. I mean, they've got an opportunity here to offset some of the costs of training, some of the tools. I mean, why not jump on board as an employer? And let's hope that apprenticeships really thrive in Illinois.
Thank you so much, Nicholas Wyman, CEO of Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation. You've also written a book, right, Nicholas?
Yeah, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Job U, and also a report called It's Time, Using Modern Apprenticeship to Reskill America, and that can be found online. You can download a free copy. It's a resource guide for employers, for employees, so there's some really good tips and thoughts in that.
And where do you go to download this? What's the website?
Just to IWSI America, which is our website, or people can just find me on Twitter at Nicholas_Wyman, and I'm happy to send people a link to download the free copy.
Well, thank you so much, Nicholas. A lot more coming up right here on WGN Radio. G here with Wintrust Business Lunch. Joining us now is real estate and money expert Elise Glink. Hi, Elise.
Hi, G. How are you?
Fantastic. So glad to have you on the show today. I opened up your email. I signed up for your newsletter. And one of the first things that caught my eye was that it said, at the end of your career, there are two big questions you need to answer. When should you retire and where should you spend your retirement years?
I know it's really kind of an interesting question, since most of us who are on the younger side think we're never going to be able to retire.
But I dream about retiring.
You know, and I don't know what retirement really is going to look like. I don't think it's going to be we're playing golf and shuffleboard all day long. But understanding a little bit more about what you want to do in retirement, what that's going to cost, and where you can do it are the keys to unlocking that big mystery of where you should buy a retirement home.
You know, it's very interesting. Just recently, I saw a couple of stories of people that were working up into their hundreds, like 103 and 106. And I thought, wow, they're still working. And then I've also read a lot of scary statistics about folks that aren't saving enough money or have nothing saved at all, and they're in their 60s.
Right. I think you're seeing a lot of people start to struggle with this whole idea that they're not going to actually have enough money in retirement. 40% of Americans are living off of Social Security exclusively, and the average benefit is less than $2,000 a month. And that's just not very much money to buy food and make sure you've got your rent payment or wherever else. And so there's a real concern over what you might want to do going forward.
You just mentioned Social Security. We actually have a text question from the 630 about Social Security. When are you first eligible to receive your benefits, and could waiting until later save you thousands of dollars a year?
Well, you would get an extra several thousand dollars a year. Let me explain how it works. When you're 62 years old, you're first eligible to tap into Social Security. But your regular retirement, that doesn't give you the full retirement benefit that if you waited to 65, 66, or 67, depending on your birth year, what you would get there. And then no matter what your full retirement age is, if you wait until you're 70 to start taking that benefit grows at, I think, about 8% per year that you wait. And so if you can wait till you're 70, you'll get a lot more money than if you wait if you start taking your Social Security at 62. But if you have no other way to make ends meet, you'll take it when you need it.
And for really young people, we just hope that there's going to be Social Security at all.
Well, it looks like there will be Social Security. I mean, even when we, quote-unquote, run out, which I think is in 20, 52 or 2049. You know, it's a ways out, but even then we'll still have enough money to fund about 77% of Social Security. And I think what it'll look like then is probably people at the higher income levels won't get a full Social Security amount. They're already being taxed on it. And so people who make less money going in, they'll be the ones who have their full benefit.
So, Elise, when should we retire?
Well, you want to be able to retire when you no longer are physically or mentally able to work. So if you're a coal miner, that may happen sooner than if you're a real estate person, a real estate salesperson, and you can keep showing houses. But at some point in time, maybe you won't be able to do that anymore. And so I think people should physically think about where they're at, mentally where they're at, and what else they would like to be doing. And so for a lot of people, retirement means helping out with grandchildren. There's a significant number of grandparents who are now providing not just financial but also child care assistance to their children and grandchildren. So you want to look at that. You also want to look at where you might want to live and what you like to do while you're still physically able to do it. And I think that's a really important thing as well. But we're often seeing people go into retirement and get part-time jobs. They're starting up home-based businesses, and they're doing other kinds of contract work to just bring in a few extra dollars and keep their mind active while they're actually doing everything else they wanted to do in retirement.
It does seem that a lot of people that I know tend to not retire. They continue to work somehow, some way.
Right. I mean, my mother, who's 82, just retired this last year from real estate, and that's because she couldn't do the stairs anymore in the houses she was showing. But I honestly, if her knees were fine, I think she'd be out there still working because she enjoys the interaction, she enjoys the intellectual challenge of it, and she built a very significant business. So I think a lot of people are like that. You know, through living in a city, if you're healthy, you're likely to be living longer and healthier lives. And so you may want to engage with people on a business level just because it stimulates you.
I'm hearing that you have a study that suggests where the best states to retire are in the United States.
Well, it's interesting. The study, which is from WalletHub, is pretty interesting. It looked at the five best and five worst states to retire in. And I don't think that it'll come as any surprise that Florida is still the number one state. And that has to do with affordability, quality of life, right? Other than the hurricanes, it's a pretty nice weather for most of the year. And the healthcare rank isn't too bad. It's 26, so about halfway. But taxes, it's hard to beat that, the tax situation in Florida. So those kinds of states that have very low taxes, nice weather, those tend to be at the highest. The number two best state to retire in is Colorado. And again, great quality of life. The healthcare rank is number four. They have a terrific healthcare system there, and it's still fairly affordable. New Hampshire is up there. Utah, again, for the taxes, beautiful location, a little bit of snow. And then Wyoming, again, for the taxes, but it gets a little bit colder there. You have to decide what's most important to you.
And what are the worst states to retire in? Just so that we can keep that in mind and avoid those states.
Well, Kentucky is considered the worst one. It's got the affordability ranking is pretty good, but the quality of life rank is low and the health care rank is low. Taxes are pretty good. New Mexico is down there. Rhode Island is down there. It's expensive to live in Rhode Island. New Jersey, it's expensive there. And then West Virginia, I think probably because it's, you know, the overall economy in West Virginia isn't great. And so it's got a lower quality of life ranking. But you can see, you know, the question that you want to ask yourself, because, again, this is all going to be very subjective, are things like what do you want to do in retirement? What are the things, where do you do those things if you like to hike, if you like to ski, if you want to be near your grandchildren, close to family, friends, house of worship? Did you want to live abroad for a while? What does that look like? What kind of medical care and health care are you going to need? All of those questions, which we talk in depth on, at Best Money Moves and ThinkLink.com, all of those questions are really important to understanding where you're going to be happy for the long run.
And, of course, one of the big questions is how much money do you need to have saved, and what about your health care costs as well, too, I'm sure.
Well, healthcare is super important, and if you've got special healthcare needs, right, if, for example, you have chronic conditions or you come from a family that as they get older, they get sicker, you're going to want to have, you know, doctors that you can trust, hospitals you can trust that are nearby. But, you know, it may be something as simple as saying, I want to, you know, healthcare to be high and I want great weather, and unfortunately, I can't afford that much, so it has to be lower cost of living, but I want to be near a university so I can take classes and have an intellectual stimulation, you'll be able to start your search and really think about where you might want to live.
Well, these great questions to ask yourself when figuring out what's best for you as to when and where to retire are on thinkglink.com. That's thinkglink.com. Thanks again to Elise Glink, CEO of Best Money Moves, our real estate and money expert. Thanks, Elise.
You're welcome, G. Talk to you next week.
G here. Welcome to the Wintrust to Business Lunch. Thank you so much for joining us today. Of course, a very quiet day with the U.S. stock and bond markets closed today in observance of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Amy Guth is in studio with us. How are you, Amy?
Hello. How's it going?
Oh, that was a very soothing greeting. Hello. I like that. You're also filling in for Anna Devlantes today as well.
Yeah, so I thought I'd just come in and just stay.
I think you should. I prefer it this way. I like you here. You know, I don't know if you heard our last interview with Elise Glink. She was talking about a Wallet Hub study of the five best and worst places in terms of states to retire in the country. And of course, Florida topped the list.
Sure.
But I wanted to give some statistics from another study. And this one came from the Black Tower Financial Management Group. And they ranked every state in the U.S. based on several factors, including cost of living, crime, and life expectancy. And surprisingly, California is one of the worst places in the country to retire based on the high cost of living.
I can see that.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the best states to retire, it's Iowa, Minnesota, and Vermont. Of course, these states are a little bit different than the states that Elise and I were talking about, only because that study came from Wallet Hub and this one comes from a different one. But the reason why I bring this one up is because Illinois is ranked. And do you want to guess the ranking?
I don't know if I even could guess, but I'm guessing we're somewhere in the middle.
You know what? We're doing a little bit better than the middle. We're ranked 19th.
Okay.
Yeah, after Michigan. Michigan is 18th and we're 19th. So we do pretty well.
They got more trees. So yeah. Trees, that's totally fair.
Yes, and it says the average property price is around $247,000. And life expectancy, if you retire in Illinois, is around 79 years old.
I'm trying to go for 103 years old, so I got to go to whatever state that is.
Well, I mentioned this in the last interview. Did you hear about this Indiana guy that was working? He was like a surveyor. And he was working until he was 104.
I mean, my grandfather was driving till close to that. He was like, for better or worse, he was driving. I don't know. I think it's interesting. There is another.
Oh, I'm sorry. 102. He retires as the oldest state employee.
Wow.
And this just happened 5 days ago, an Indiana man.
He deserves a very big party.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Nearly six decades on the job as a surveyor for the Indiana Department of Natural Resources.
I hope he gets more than a gold watch. He deserves much, much more. Maybe a gold Ferrari or something.
He was
like
a World War II veteran, and he joined the agency in 1962. And basically, he decided that it was about time to retire because he said he just, you know, wasn't as...
Because I'm 102 years old, and I'm ready to sit down for a minute. That's reasonable to me.
I think that's impressive.
I recently saw another kind of survey, a little more informally done, right? Because it was who's going to respond to an online survey. So it's based on the people who did respond. But it was the states that... It is based on your state. What state do you hate the most?
Oh,
it was very funny. It was like a color coded map. So it was like Illinois has the biggest rivalry since with Indiana. Like who? What state do you talk the most trash about? It was with Indiana. What I thought was very funny is Florida was coded to hate Florida. So Florida is like a self-hating state. It has its own grief.
You need to teach Florida some self-love.
But it's mostly like the state right next door, right? So it was like the thing right next door where you're going to like have a little rivalry or something like that. I thought it was kind of funny.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's trending. What story are you keeping an eye on?
A story that I'm watching that I think is really interesting. This just launched, and every year Edelman PR does this Trust Survey. It is like the Edelman Trust Barometer, right? So the 2020 version has just come out. And what they look at is you, the worker, what do you expect of your boss? What do you expect of the government? What do you expect of corporations, democracy? I mean, it tackles some very big issues. And I think it's really interesting. 92%, which is a whopping number, 92% of the workers surveyed say that they expect their CEO or whatever leader title their boss has, right, to actively speak up on issues, social issues, environmental. So we're talking about climate change, income inequality, gender pay gap, gender inequity, things like that. They expect not just their CEO would do something about it if they made a misstep, but should actively be going, huh, here's what we need to do. This is our, you know, this is our mission. This is what we're going to be doing. And a lot of people mentioned feeling like, oh, a lot of people say that this should be happening, but it's really a PR stunt. It's not real. So this is really interesting. I mean, this is a big step from the previous surveys that were kind of like, sure, yeah, companies should have some environmental responsibility to, no, my CEO straight up needs to be speaking up. About 92% of people surveyed in out of 33,000 people in 30 global markets. So that's a big swath of people.
That was just what I was going to ask you. How many people are involved in this study? I'm not familiar with this study. And you say this is something that happens every year.
Yeah, it's been happening for the last few years. It's really interesting to go back and look at them and kind of read, because it's very in depth. There's a, you know, you can, if you Google it, you can find it against the Edelman Trust Barometer. You can read all about, but it was interesting. So despite a lot of criticism of organizations, they're like, you know, businesses do a good job of serving the owners, not so much the workers, although all the people surveyed for the most part said, yeah, it is the company's responsibility to shore up pay gaps and to make sure wage equality is happening and you're not, you know, paying people poverty wages, things like that. There was still higher trust in business than there was government to tackle some of these big issues.
Uh-huh.
But it was like, I'm sorry, that's reverse. But it was like by a very small margin, right?
So what happens from this study? Do you, you know, corporations read this and they're like, I should change my ways.
As the CEO of Amy Guth Inc., I think I should change my ways. No, I think, you know, it's a kind of a signal flare, right? For leaders to go, okay, well, I wonder if this is valuable in this workplace culture here where I work, right? So to me, I think it's kind of an opportunity for leaders to say, well, I do need to look at the culture of my workplace and see what is valuable to my workers. And if this holds true, maybe we need to make some shifts or not. But at least I think it's a moment to consider a rapidly changing social moment that we're in.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Something else fascinating that I hope you find interesting is, have you heard about this Beyonce new collaboration? It's her Ivy Park.
I can't keep up with Beyonce.
Ivy Park.
I don't try to.
Ivy Park brand with Adidas. Producer Jasmine and I were talking about it a little bit this morning. It's a streetwear collection, and it's been highly anticipated. Of course, this is so much money is involved in, you know, with all of these streetwear brands, and especially with collaborations with celebrities. But apparently fans are slamming it because there is a lack of plus sizes. Have you been hearing about this, Jasmine?
All the time. Her sizes in her clothing run small. Like, this is something that has been known. So I don't know why she hasn't necessarily updone herself to make it better.
But she's all about body positivity. It's about all that jelly and, like, being curvy.
Now, no offense, but Beyonce is like a size 6. Now, that's not average for most Americans.
That's
so
very
she has
true.
To think about it.
Okay. So she's kind of talking this talk, but like perhaps it's not living. Not
right.
that I'm talking smack about
right.
Beyonce.
Me either.
I do not want lightning to strike me.
We don't want the beehive after us. But apparently this is in stark contrast, fans say, to Rihanna's line, her Savage and Fenty lingerie collection, which is available in U.S. from sizes 20 to 22. So anyway, there you go.
Well,
a little bit of a trending story.
I could go on for hours about this, but I think, you know, there is not any kind of like standardized sizing or anything like that. And it is frustrating. I mean, like, as a very tall woman, if I order a tall size, that could mean a lot of things. It usually still means it's a 3/4 length sleeve, not actually to my wrist.
If I could just find a pair of jeans that fit me properly, I'll be happy. Okay. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.